Well, for ourselves, we're going to embark on a look at the book of Job, and I want to take the first dozen verses, the first chapter, and read them with you this morning. So if you have a Bible, you can look with me at them, or else the words will be on the screen for you, and you can follow them through there. Job chapter 1, and the first 12 verses of this Old Testament book. In the land of Uz, there lived a man whose name was Job. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters. He owned 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 donkeys, and had a large number of servants. He was the greatest man among all the people of the East. His sons used to take turns holding feasts in their homes, and they'd invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. When a period of feasting had run its course, Job would send and have them purified. Early in the morning, he would sacrifice a burnt offering for each of them, thinking, "Perhaps my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." This was Job's regular custom. One day, the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them. The Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Satan answered the Lord, "From roaming through the earth and going back and forth in it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There's no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil." "Does Job fear God for nothing?" Satan replied. "Have you not put a hedge around him and his household and everything he has? You've blessed the work of his hands so that his flocks and herds are spread throughout the land. But stretch out your hand and strike everything he has, and he will surely curse you to your face." The Lord said to Satan, "Very well. Then everything he has is in your hands, but on the man himself do not lay a finger." Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. So reads God's word, and we know he'll touch our hearts through his message as we open our hearts to him today. The novelist Virginia Woolf wrote in one of her famous letters, "I read the book of Job last night. God does not come out of it very well." And before you criticize Virginia Woolf for such a terrible indictment on God's behavior in the book of Job, I ask you when the last time was that you read the whole book of Job in an evening. Indeed, for this series, I tried to read it through several times myself, but it certainly took me more than an evening to wade through complicated and difficult passages of Scripture. But I want to look at the whole book of Job over the next wee while and to take you through what is an interesting and I think a very timely book for our generation. The first 2 headings this morning are headings really that introduce the book and its difficulties and complexities to us. I speak first of all simply of Job's challenge, for it is a very challenging book. It comes basically in 3 parts. The first part is a part we tend to know fairly well and fairly easily. The first part is an interesting narrative of a man who had enormous possessions, a brilliant life, a happy lifestyle, and then suddenly things began to go wrong for him and everything crumbled. The third part of the book, the last part, is a very interesting conversation between God and that man, Job. God explains himself to Job at a certain level, and Job realizes he's been a wee bit wonky in some of his thinking and talking. Part two, between part one and three, are 35 chapters of a conversation that Job has with his comforters or friends. And if you're aware of the English phrase, Job's comforters, you know it's not a very positive phrase. They didn't do the job terribly well. Although sometimes I think they're maligned a wee bit too strongly. That conversation is very difficult for us to grasp. And that's why, folks, we've been well acquainted with the first part, tolerably well acquainted with part three, but just say, you know, that middle chunk, if you could just leave that out, it'd be grand. It'd be a good book if those 35 chapters weren't there in the middle. Difficult chapters, challenging chapters, because they're good Hebrew approach to poetry. They go round and round in circles, gradually building up a picture, but it's not easy for our mindset to grasp. It's a little wonder that often those chapters are either dodged by preachers completely or passed over very, very quickly. Very few preachers will tackle the whole book. And as I near old age and retirement, I confess publicly I've never preached through the whole book of Job in my life. Charles Swindoll has one of many modern commentaries on the book of Job, and it's quite an accessible commentary. And if you're looking for something to check me out week by week, take Charles Swindoll's commentary on the book of Job, available in the evangelical bookshop quite freely. He talks at the start of his commentary, as most of them prefaces, what his gratitude is to certain people. He expresses gratitude to his secretary. He addresses some words of thanks to the editors, etc. And then he has a word of thanks to the church, his church, to whom he preached the whole book of Job during the course of a year. He records candidly how on the Sunday in which he announced the conclusion to the series, he says the whole congregation exploded with loud, spontaneous applause. They're glad the end was in sight, I guess. So I'll allow you that whenever our series does come to an end. The challenge, of course, is if we do believe, as we believe as evangelical Christians, that all of Scripture is God-breathed and for our benefit, then we can't actually look at those 35 chapters and say, oh, that's just a bit of padding, we can leave that out. Somewhere in God's writing of those chapters through Job, there's a point, there's a purpose in this extended period of time through which Job's sufferings seem to increase with his friends' desires to help him and explain things to him. But it is a challenging book, and that's why I've started talking about the challenge of Job, first of all. Secondly, a bit about Job's themes. What's the book about? The very first theme, one that I think is often overlooked, but I want to start with it this morning, is the blessings of Job. Good Job. A man well blessed by God in every domain of his life. An important theme, for it sets the rest of the book into its context. There are, of course, then extended themes about suffering, its causes, and its cures. And again, in a world today where many people have their own theory about how to get through suffering when it comes, it's an important book. There are deeper themes that surround what God permits in our lives and what God causes in our lives. When things happen, it's easy for the Christian to say, well, I know that God's on his throne and he's in charge. The dilemma is God on his throne actually causing the hard time I'm going through, or is God simply allowing other people, other powers, other things to do those things to me? That question, what God permits and what God causes, it is part of the struggle inside of this book of Job. A deeper issue still, and one that I think lots of us will be well acquainted with, is about God's silence, God's apparent indifference to Job's situation. One of the reasons I think there are 35 chapters in the middle is they accentuate the length of time Job had to put up with God not saying anything. Lots of us in life, I think, can do stuff, cope with stuff, put up with things if God makes his purpose clear at the start, or at least fairly early on in the day. Far harder to put up with the things that life throws at us when we ask God for his reason, ask God for purpose, ask God where this is heading, and get silence as the only response from heaven. Big issue, and one we'll try to tackle in the course of these next chapters. There's a hugely important theme in the closing chapters about what it means to believe in God as creator. If you read through the book, you find there's no references here to God saving through the death of Jesus Christ on the cross. Very little reference to sacrificial ministry at all, except Job is the one who did the sacrifices for his family. No references to Israel as a nation in covenant with God from Abraham onwards. The bulk of the book is about how Job deals with God as creator and how God as creator deals with Job. And the creation theology of the book is a great theme and one we'll have a look at as well. And finally, we'll discover that there is in this book a view of God as redeemer of his people. Perhaps not in the terminology we normally use, but still helpful. Along those major themes are many smaller ones as well. Plenty to warm our souls through the long chapters that lie ahead. I want to start with what I simply call Job's character. Job's Challenges is a difficult book, and I would encourage you to try and read it, but don't beat yourselves up if you get halfway through the book and then say, oh, this is a bit tough going, I'll leave this to tomorrow, and tomorrow never comes. Job's themes are many and varied. Don't just take a simplistic view that this is just about suffering. There are other issues that we're going to face as well. But it's Job's character that I want to spend a bit longer on this morning. Job's character so impeccable that some Bible students have decided he can't be for real. That Job himself, and indeed the whole book, is rather just a kind of extended parable. I think against such a notion is first our introduction to Job here in chapter 1, there was a man. And that seems to be a phrase that is saying there actually was somebody, and his name was Job. He's both named and then located in Uz, a place in Edom. And that's not typical of parable approaches in Bible terms. He's mentioned by Ezekiel in the Old Testament as being a real character in history. And he's held up for us in the New Testament as being an example of godly patience. You know the patience of Job. Now, if Job is a fictitious character, and an idealized form of somebody, then it'd be fairly meaningless to say, well, you try and have the same kind of patience as Job. He'd only make believe if that was the case. To me, the whole force of the book rests on the fact that here's a real man with a real life situation, asking real questions and experiencing real pain. Someone that we can identify with. But here in the first part of the book, it's his spiritual character that's summed up for us in verse 1. Blameless, upright, someone who feared God and shunned evil. I don't think that's a description of someone who'd reached sinless perfection. And if he had reached sinless perfection at that point, he lost it fairly soon afterwards. So don't build a theology of sinless perfection on the verge of verse 1. But nonetheless, it's a description of someone who lived very close to God. First Sunday of the year, we looked at Psalm 1 and thought of the person who's blessed in life because they don't walk in the counsel of the ungodly, they don't stand in the way of sinners, they don't sit in the seat of the scornful or the mockers. And Job fits that. And so it shouldn't surprise us that this ancient character from history is a blessed man who walked with God and shunned the way of evil. And both things are mentioned in these opening verses. He actively rejected the temptations that came his way, and he positively chose what is good and upright. Both are important. If I take the football analogy, there's a defense part of life and there's an attack part of life, and both are needed. He defended himself against temptations and he actively pursued what was good. He reached for the goal and achieved it. The fact that God repeats those very terms of verse 1 later on when he talks to Satan, I think shows how authentic this good Job actually was. Indeed, it's a theme that will run through the book. Part of the theme of the book is here is a good man, a high-quality man, somebody God says is the best person alive in the world today to Satan. And it's how those very qualities are put under the microscope, how they're scrutinized and put to the test. Part of the book is to say to us, actually, you know, you need high-caliber Christianity if you're going to face the storms of life. No point saying, well, you know, I'll just carry on as I am, and if a real bad time comes, then I'll start to think about spiritual realities. Lots of us do that in life. God's patient enough to take us nonetheless, but it's not the ideal. God's plan and purpose for us is to have high-caliber spirituality, close walk with him that will prepare us for what lies ahead of us. The interesting truth is that it was possible for a real person like Job to be of such high character. I think sometimes we get so used to emphasizing the truth that we are sinful, we are fallen, we're part of a depraved and fallen humanity and creation. We're not going to be perfect till we get to heaven. And so we get to the stage where we think, well, I just put up with how I am then. I don't achieve anything more spiritually than what I am. We can't attain a high standard. We're just all fallen people in a fallen, sinful world. And yet here's Job, possibly living about Abraham's time, maybe even earlier, maybe not even in Israel, maybe in Edom, without covenant relationship to God in terms of the Old Testament covenants, without New Testament knowledge of Jesus Christ and him crucified, who is held up by God as someone who is morally and spiritually upright, someone who feared God, was morally good, rejected temptation and pursued what was good. It is possible. And I guess sometimes we need just to take a reality check on ourselves. Am I excusing myself too much as being a fallen person in a fallen and sinful world? And saying, well, that's just how it is, so I'm going to have to put up with that. Rather than strive towards that goal that Job reached and which God blessed. I was thinking through the week, sometimes we're a bit like that in our physical health. We kind of take the line, well, you know, if I have a heart scare, then I will start doing lots of exercise. Or if I am detected with diabetes, then after that, I'll start to eat more healthily. I really like that spiritually, you know, if the crisis comes, then we'll respond to the crisis. Whereas God's saying, actually, you should eat healthily and you should do lots of exercise to keep your physical health good. And in the spiritual realm, live close to God now. Because Job's going to tell us that even when you live like that, suffering is still hard to take and cope with. Job's character. Fourthly, Job's blessings. When you read verses 2 and 3 of chapter 1, you could be forgiven for thinking, you know, the Bible is kind of judging people the same way that our materialistic secular society does. If you analyze those first 3 or 4 verses, there's 12 words thereabouts, depending which language you're reading from, but 12 words to describe his spiritual and moral life. Then there are 4 times as many words to tell us about his family and his possessions. And when, like you, you're good spiritual people, and you come to church for spiritual benefit on Sunday morning, you read these words and say, well, do I really need to know that he owned 7,000 sheep? You know, I can understand God telling me he was upright, he was morally good, he sought what was right, he shunned what was wrong, but what's the point in telling me he owns 7,000 sheep? Is there any great spiritual benefit to me this morning in knowing he had 500 donkeys? It seems to me that's kind of the way the world works. You know, the world won't look at somebody's moral or spiritual standing. They'll focus on what they own, what they possess. But we don't expect the Bible to do that. And we don't expect the Bible to have it kind of so lopsided, you know, 4 things or 4 phrases about his spiritual life and then 4 times as many about his possessions, sheep and donkeys and servants and all the rest. Well, the answer is actually it's very important, and for several reasons. Firstly, because they're viewed as God's blessings to Job. God blesses people. While the rest of the book of Job might focus our minds rightly on what God allows to test us to the absolute limit, Job begins as a book with God who as creator blesses and in fact ends with a picture of God who as creator blesses. If we're going to grasp the whole book of Job, it needs to be within those 2 parameters. God as creator blesses at the beginning and God as creator blesses at the end. That's what God's like. He's a God who blesses. He's a God who's good. Holding to that by faith when appearances seem to suggest something else is the heart of a true relationship with God. Believing that God is still good when I can't see it is what faith is about. Having an absolute conviction that God's goodness is magnificent when every circumstance in life is shouting at me to disbelieve that is the heart of what Job had to encounter in his life. So to present this picture of the blessings of God to Job at the beginning is essential. It sets the scene. That is how he has experienced God in his life up till then. These things are not the result of him being a brilliant farmer, a wonderful businessman, or a supreme trader in the world of his day, or a successful entrepreneur. This is about God who has blessed Job. It's one of the reasons why the next verses are there, because Job follows up every family festival with a sacrifice to God. And in verse 5, we get the reason he's just scared stiff in case, not because it's happened, but in case in some of the parties, some suggest the birthday parties, some suggest it was the fun and festivity of people who are well blessed, that his family may possibly have sinned or cursed God. And so just in case, he offers a sacrifice to God, verse 5. He saw God's hand of blessing on him and didn't want that to be changed. When things do change and his blessings start to evaporate, he still acknowledges in verse 21, the Lord gave. That's where it came from. It wasn't his own clever scheming and trading and working. It was the blessing of God upon him. So a crucial part of understanding the whole book of Job is we get this picture of a man who himself was morally upright and good and spiritually feared the Lord, and a man whom God had richly, richly blessed. We'll never be able to understand the bad stuff in our lives if we don't understand the good stuff in our lives. If we think all the good stuff in our lives is due to us, to me, my cleverness, my ingenuity, my hard work, my family background, my status, my role in life, if I think the good stuff comes from me, I'm not allowed to handle it when the good stuff goes and I can't do a thing about it. If I believe the good stuff comes from God, then as Job was to express, if God gives me the good stuff, then God has a right to give me the bad stuff as well. That makes sense. A God who's a creator God in charge of all that's happening. So the blessings are essential there in terms of understanding that God has blessed this man and given him the good stuff in life. Secondly, there, because the blessings formed part of Satan's accusation in verses 9 to 11. We'll look at this again more fully in weeks to come. But if you know the story, you know what goes on here. Satan says to God, "You know what, God? The only reason Job loves you, fears you, trusts you, reverences you, respects you, the only reason he does that is because you put a hedge around him. You put so much good stuff in his life. That's why he cares about you. He knows what side his bread's buttered on. He's not going to bite the hand that feeds him. But, says Satan, if you take those blessings away from him, you'll find that what's left is nothing. Job doesn't love you because you're God. He loves you because you're good to him." That's a challenge that Satan puts out to God himself. Because Satan cannot imagine that God can be loved just because he's God. That God can be reverenced just because he's God. That God can be feared just because he's God. That God is worth everything I am and have just because he's God. Interestingly, God has higher estimates of his children than Satan does. One of the lovely themes of this book is that God believes Job. And believes that this man, Job, will still love him when everything is gone. He's absolutely convinced Job loves me, the living God, because I'm God, not because I'm good to him. Because you see how those blessings were crucial to that. If Job was just skimping along with a tough, rough life barely existing, then there'd be no substance to Satan's accusation. It is the vastness of the blessings in material terms that makes Satan's accusation all the more powerful. Thirdly, the blessings are important because they form the large part of what Job is going to lose. The bigger the blessing, the bigger the loss. Job had to be tested to prove his love for God was thorough and authentic. And it's the loss of vast, vast blessings and possessions, family and stuff, that is that test track on which Job's faith in God is going to be tested. When a new car is being developed, eventually at some point in time it's taken to a test track and given extreme treatment. Just because that car, newly developed, could be driven comfortably around the car park outside the factory doesn't actually prove very much. The real proof is if that car can be driven endlessly, hour after hour, day after day, over cobbles and all kinds of other simulated surfaces, and in the extremity, the quality of the car is proved one way or the other. What God sets up for us is somebody who has been blessed more than any other person in the world at that point in time, who will lose more than any other person in the world at that time. And it's the loss of those blessings that is a test track on which the life and faith of Job will be tested. Satan didn't doubt Job's relationship with God for a minute. He just doubted whether it would survive the test track, the removal of all the blessings in life. Now, I guess for lots of us, the question is, would God ever put me through that? Would I come out of it very well? Is Satan right about Christianity today, that people love God because he's good to them? And that if God takes all the good stuff out of their lives, bit by bit by bit, and strips them of every blessing, they'll curse God. They won't have any love for him left. There'll be nothing. I actually don't believe that's true. Because how Satan thought about Job is how Satan thinks about you and me still today. And sometimes he sows that doubt, that accusation in our minds. Yeah, get it hard enough. Hit me with a period of persecution. Throw me in prison for my faith. Threaten me with death. And I'm not sure whether I'll stand or not. And part of the purpose of Job as a book is to help God's people to say, you know what? You know what? God is so good. God is so great. God is so wise. God is so powerful that I actually love him because he's God, not just because he's good. The book of Job and the person of Job keep on saying to us as a people, God is worth respect. God is worth faith. God is worth reverence. God is worth the totality of my love in every situation, in every age and era, and by every person. And here's a series which I trust will call us to affirm that truth, not just in the kind of doctrinal, theoretical, theological bit of our heads, but say, God, I'm up for this in practical things in life. Though you slay me, yet will I love you. That's Job's God. A good God for a good Job.